too short for him. She glanced at the corner where Rollo slept. He was stretched out straight as a knife, head between his paws. Ian put a hand on her leg and sank into sleep. She could see him doing it, his face going slack and peaceful, the muscles of his shoulders easing. It was why she'd kept the candle lit, so she might watch him sleep for a little and let the sight of him bring her peace as well. She'd put on her shift, feeling obscurely exposed, and though it was hot enough to lie above the sheet, she'd pulled it over her legs too, wanting to be able to feel Ian when she moved in her sleep. She moved a leg toward him now, slowly, and felt the touch of his knee against her calf. His long lashes cast shadows on his cheeks in the candlelight, just above the looping line of his tattoos. "Thee is my wolf," she'd said to him, "and if thee hunts at night, thee will come home."
"And sleep at thy feet," he'd replied.
She sighed, but felt better, and opened her Bible to read a psalm before blowing out the candle, only to discover that she had absently picked up Pamela, or Virtue Rewarded, from the bedside table. She gave a small snort of amusement, and all sense of distress now driven from her mind, closed the book, put out the candle, and snuggled down beside her sleeping wolf. Sometime much later, in the empty hours before dawn, she opened her eyes. Not asleep, but certainly not awake. She had a sense of perfect consciousness without thought, and a distinct and vivid sense that she was not alone. Ian was beside her. His breath touched her face. But she felt quite apart from him. It was only when it happened again that she realized what had wakened her. A tiny, sharp pain in her belly. Like the pain that sometimes came when she started her monthly, but smaller. Less an ache than a stab. A stab of awareness. She blinked and put her hands over her stomach. The rafters were just barely visible overhead, shadowed with the distant coming of the light. The pain had stopped, but the sense of company, or presence rather, that hadn't gone away. It seemed very odd and completely natural. And of course it was, she thought, natural as the beating of her own heart and the breath in her lungs. She had a faint impulse to wake Ian, but that passed almost at once. She wanted to keep this for now, be alone with the knowledge. But not alone, she corrected herself, and sank peacefully back to sleep, hands still crossed over her lively womb. Ian usually woke before her, but she always felt him stir and would rise to the edge of wakefulness to enjoy his sleepy, warm smell, the small male sounds he made, and the feel of his legs brushing hers as he swung them out of bed and sat up. He'd sit there on the edge for a moment, rubbing his hands through his hair and getting his bearings on the day. And if she cracked her eyes open, she could see his long, lovely back just in front of her, columnar muscles tanned by the sun and sloping gently down to his neat, tight buttocks, white as milk in contrast. Sometimes he would emit a small popping fart and look guiltily over his shoulder. She'd shut her eyes instantly and pretend to be still asleep, thinking that she must be completely besotted to find this adorable. But she did. This morning, though, he sat up, rubbed a hand through his hair, and stiffened. She opened her eyes all the way, instantly alarmed by something in his posture. "Ian?" she whispered, but he didn't attend.
"Aya," he said, very softly. "Arno, Aharich."
She knew at once, should have known from the instant she woke, because Rollo woke when Ian did, stretching and yawning with a groaning creak of jaw muscles and a lazy thump of tail against the wall, before coming to poke a cold nose into his master's hand. This morning there was only stillness and the curled form of what used to be Rollo. Ian rose and went to him swiftly, knelt on the floor beside the body of his dog, and laid a gentle hand on the big furry head. He didn't say anything or weep, but she heard the sound he made when he breathed, as of something tearing in his chest. She got out of bed and came to Ian, kneeling beside him, arm about his waist. And she was weeping, quite without meaning to. "Mohuch," Ian said, running his hand lightly over the soft, thick fur. "Mohuch." There was a catch in his voice when he said, "Goodbye, old friend." Then he sat back on his heels, took a deep breath, and clasped Rachel's hand very hard.
"He waited, I think, until he kent you were here for me."
He swallowed audibly, and his voice was steady when he spoke again.
"I'll need to bury him. I ken a place, but it's some way. I'll be back by mid-afternoon, though."
"I'll come with thee."
Her nose was running. She reached for the towel by the ewer and blew her nose on one end.
"You needn't, Macrea," he said gently,
and passed a hand over her hair to smooth it.
"It's a long way."
She drew breath and stood up. "Then we best get started." She touched her husband on the shoulder as lightly as he'd touched Rollo's fur. "I married him, as well as thee."
Chapter 116. A Hunting We Will Go. September the 15th, 1778. First Watchung Mountain. There was a neat mound of droppings by the path, dark and glistening as coffee beans, and much the same size. William was leading his mare, owing to her stoutness and the steep nature of the trail, so took the opportunity to stop for a moment and let her breathe. This she did, with an explosive snort and a shake of her mane. He squatted and scooped up a few of the pellets, sniffing. Very fresh, though not warm, and with a faint oaky tang that meant the deer had been browsing on green acorns. Glancing to his left, he saw the broken brush that marked the animal's passage, and his hand twitched, wanting to wrap itself round his rifle. He could leave the mare tethered.
"What about it, old lass?" he asked the mare in the accents of the Lake District where he'd grown up. "Would he carry a carcass if I shot him?"
The mare was maybe 14, old enough to be steady. In fact, it would be hard to imagine a steady amount. She was more like riding a sofa than a horse, with her broad back and sides curved like a hogshead of beer. But he hadn't thought to ask, when he bought her, whether she was used to hunting. Steadiness of gait and a mild temper didn't necessarily mean she'd be fine if he heaved a deer across her back, leaking blood. Still, he lifted his face to the breeze, perfect. It was straight across the mountainside toward him, and he imagined he could actually smell that. Something moved in the wood, snapping twigs, and he heard the unmistakable rustling, the sound of a large, herbivorous creature wrenching mouthfuls of leaves off a tree. Before he could think twice, he got to his feet, slipped the rifle from its sheath as silently as he could, and shucked his boots. Soft-footed as a ferret, he slid into the brush. And 5 minutes later, grasped the thrashing, stubby antlers of a yearling buck with one hand as he slit the deer's throat with the other, the sound of his shot still echoing off the rocky escarpment above him. It had happened so fast it scarcely seemed real, despite the warm, cold feel of the blood soaking into his stockings and the thick smell of it. There was a tick hanging just under the deer's glazing eye, round as a tiny muscat grape. Would it let go at once, he wondered, or would there be enough blood left for it to go on feeding for some time? The deer shuddered violently, shoving its antlers hard into his chest, bunched its legs convulsively as though about to make one final leap, and died. He held it for a few moments, the shredded velvet still on the antlers like rough suede under his sweating palm,
the weight of the coarse-haired shoulders growing heavy on his knee.
"Thank you," he whispered, and let go.
He remembered that it had been Mac the groom who told him that you always thanked a creature that gave you its life. And that it had been James Fraser, some years later, who had killed a huge wapiti in front of him, and spoken what he said was a Gralloch prayer, in Gaelic, before butchering the beast. But with the deer's blood on his skin, and the breeze moving in the wood around him, for once he didn't push those memories away. He went to check the mare, who was fortunately close to where he'd left her, having merely moved a few yards in order to crop weeds, and who looked at him with tranquil eyes, yellow wildflowers dangling from the corners of her mouth, as though gunshots and the smell of blood were commonplace in her life. Perhaps they were, he thought, and slapped her shoulder companionably.
"Here's for you, Ben," he thought a few minutes later,
slitting the belly skin. His cousin, nearly 6 years older than himself, had taken him hunting now and then in the forest near Erlingden with Viscount Almerding, a friend of Ben's whose preserve it was. He tried not to think of his cousin too much as he'd made his preparations. The greater part of him truly believed that Ben was dead. Jail fever, according to what Richardson had told his uncle. Not an unusual thing to happen to a prisoner by any means. And while he was convinced, reluctantly, for it made him burn with shame to have been such a flat as to have been gulled by the man, that Richardson was probably a villain, that didn't necessarily mean that every word from the man's mouth was a lie. Granted, he'd found no other trace of Ben in several weeks of searching. But there was the small part of his heart that wouldn't give up, and a larger part that would do anything he could to ease the grief of his uncle and father, whatever the truth might prove to be. "And if you bloody come down to it, what the hell else is there for me to do?" he muttered, reaching into the steaming heat of the body and groping for the heart. At least he'd be welcome when he walked into Middlebrook Encampment, as they called it. A man bearing fresh meat was always welcome. A half hour later, he'd gutted the carcass and wrapped his canvas bedsack around it to keep off flies. The horse flared her nostrils and snorted in disgust at the smell, but made no great objection when he wrestled it onto her back. It was late in the afternoon, but this late in the summer it would stay light for some time. Better, he thought, to make his first approach at supper time. Chances were good that he'd be invited to sit down with someone, and conversation was much easier over food and drink. He'd gone up to the rocky summit in order to survey the terrain, and had to admit that Washington and his engineers had chosen well. From the top of First Watchung Mountain, which he was standing on, the plains before New Brunswick lay clear below. The Continentals could easily keep a beady eye on the British Army from their eyrie, and swoop down to interfere with their movements. And had. The armies were gone now, though, both of them. The British to New York, Washington's troops to, well, wherever they might be at the moment. They weren't here, and that was all to the good. But there were people still who lived near the encampment. Ben had been, was, he corrected himself fiercely, an officer, an infantry captain like himself. And captured officers were often billeted upon local householders under parole. That was the place to begin his inquiries. "Come on then, lass," he said to the mare, untying the reins from the sapling he'd wrapped them round. "Let's go and make ourselves welcome." Chapter 117. Into the Briar Patch. September the 16th, 1778, Philadelphia. We'd just finished supper, and I was wiping Henri Christian's face with the hem of my apron when a knock came at the alley door. Jenny, sitting next to me with Félicité on her lap, gave me a quick glance, brows raised. Was this cause for alarm? I hadn't time to shrug or shake my head. All conversation had ceased on the instant, the children's chatter quelled as though someone had dropped a candle snuffer over them. It was first dark, and the door was bolted.
Fergus and Jamie exchanged looks, and without a word, both of them rose. Jamie stood to one side, hand on his dirk. I hadn't realized until this moment that he wore it all the time now, even at table. I heard the shuffle of feet in the alley. There was more than one man out there, and the hair stirred on my nape. Jamie stood relaxed but watchful, weight on his back foot, ready, as Fergus lifted the bar.
"Bonsoir,"
Fergus said calmly, with an interrogative lift at the end of the phrase. A face hovered pale in the dark, not close enough to recognize.
"Bonsoir, Monsieur Fraser."
I blinked in surprise.
I knew the voice, but had never heard Benedict Arnold speak French.
But of course he could, I thought, recovering. He'd led more than one campaign in Quebec. It was a soldier's French he spoke, rough but serviceable.
"Madame Fraser est ici, monsieur," he said. "Votre mère."
Fergus glanced reflexively over his shoulder at Jenny, astonished. I coughed and eased Henri Christian off my lap, smoothing his rumpled hair. "I rather think the governor means me," I said. The governor turned aside and murmured something to his aide, who nodded and retired into the shadows.
"Mrs. Fraser," Arnold said, sounding relieved.
Fergus stood aside and the governor came in, bowing to Marsali and Jenny, nodding to Jamie, before fixing his attention on me.
"Yes, I do mean you, ma'am. I beg pardon for my untimely intrusion, sir," he added, turning to Fergus. "I wasn't sure where Mrs. Fraser was residing, and was obliged to make inquiries."
I saw Jamie's mouth tighten briefly at this galling reference to our homelessness, but he bowed courteously.
"And I dare say the matter is urgent, sir, since you come to make your inquiries in person." "It is, rather."
The governor turned to me.
"I come to beg a favour of you, ma'am, on behalf of a friend."
He looked a little better than he had the last time I'd seen him. He'd gained a bit of weight and his colour was better. But the lines and smudges of strain and fatigue were still plain in his face. The eyes, though, were as alert as ever. "This would be a sick friend?" I asked, already glancing toward the ladder that led to the loft where we slept, where the box holding my modest pharmacopoeia was kept when I wasn't holding regular surgery hours.
"A matter of injury, ma'am, rather than illness," Arnold said,
and his mouth tightened involuntarily.
"Severe injury."
"Oh, well then, I'd better..." Jamie stopped me, a hand on my arm, and his eyes on Arnold.
"A moment, Sassenach," he said quietly. "Before I let you go, I want to know the nature of the injury and the name of the injured man. And I also want to ken why the governor comes to you under cover of night and hides his intent from his own aide."
The colour rose in Arnold's cheeks, but he nodded.
"Fair enough, Mr. Fraser. Do you know a man called Shippen?"
Jamie looked blank and shook his head, but Fergus chimed in.
"I do," he said, looking thoughtfully at Arnold. "He's a wealthy man, and a well-known loyalist, one of those who chose not to leave the city when the British army withdrew."
"I knew one of the Shippen girls," I said, with a vague memory of General Howe's lavish leaving party in May.
God,
could that possibly be only 3 months past? "I don't think I met the father, though. Is he the injured party?"
"No, but he is the friend on whose behalf I ask your help, ma'am."
Arnold drew a deep, unhappy breath.
"Mr. Shippen's young cousin, a man named Tench Bledsoe, was set upon last night by the Sons of Liberty. They tarred and feathered him, ma'am, and left him on the docks in front of Mr. Shippen's warehouse. He rolled off the dock into the river and by a mercy didn't drown, but crept up the bank and lay in the muddy shallows until a slave hunting crabs found him and ran for help."
"Help," Jamie repeated carefully. Arnold met his eye and nodded.
"Just so, Mr. Fraser," he said bleakly. "The Shippens live within 2 streets of Dr. Benjamin Rush, but under the circumstances..."
The circumstances being that Benjamin Rush was a very visible and outspoken rebel, active in the Sons of Liberty, and would certainly be familiar with everyone in Philadelphia who held similar sentiments, very likely including the men who had attacked Tench Bledsoe.
"Sit down, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, gesturing to my stool. I didn't, and he gave me a brief, dark look.
"I didn't mean to stop you going," he said, a distinct edge in his voice. "And I ken well enough that you will. I just mean to make sure you come back, aye?"
Yes, I said, and coughed. "I'll just go and get my things together, then." I sidled through the clump of staring children to the ladder and went up as quickly as I could, hearing Jamie's stern inquisition of Governor Arnold begin behind me. Severe burns and the attendant difficulties of hardened tar, and very likely fever and infection already started after a night lying in river mud. This was going to be messy, and possibly worse. There was no telling how badly the young man had been burned. If we were lucky, it might be only splashes of tar that had reached his skin. If we weren't lucky. I set my jaw and began packing. Linen bandages, a scalpel, and small paring knife for debridement. Leeches? Perhaps. There would certainly be bruising involved. No one submitted meekly to being tarred and feathered. I tied a hasty bandage around the leech jar to keep the lid from coming off in transit. Definitely a jar of honey. I held it up to the flicker of light from below. Half full, a clouded gold that caught the light through brown glass like candle glow. Fergus kept a tin of turpentine in the shed for cleaning type. I should borrow that as well. I didn't worry over much about the political delicacies that had made Arnold come to me so surreptitiously. Jamie would take what precautions were possible, I knew. Philadelphia lay in rebel hands, but it was by no means a safe place for anyone. Not for the first time, or the last, I was sure. I was glad that at least my own path lay clear before me. The door below opened and closed with a thump. The governor was gone. I looked at the rather grubby sedan chair, inhaled the scent of several dozen previous users, and took a firmer grip on my cane. "I can walk," I said. "It's not that far."
"You're not walking," Jamie replied equably.
"Surely you don't intend to stop me."
"Aye, I do," he said, still mildly. "I canna stop you going, and I wouldna try. But I can, by God, make sure you dinna fall on your face in the street on your way. Get in, Sassenach. Go slow," he added to the chairman as he opened the door of the sedan and gestured to me. "I'm coming, and I dinna want to gallop so soon after supper."
There being no reasonable alternative, I gathered the remnants of my dignity and got in. And with my basket of supplies settled at my feet, and the window slid open as far as it would go, the memories of my last claustrophobic ride in a sedan chair were as vivid as the smell of this one, we set off at a stately jog through the quiet nighttime streets of Philadelphia. The curfew had been eased of late, owing to protests from tavern owners, and likely their patrons, but the overall sense of the city was still edgy, and there were no respectable women on the street, no gangs of rowdy apprentices, or any of the slaves who worked for their masters, but lived on their own. I saw one whore standing by the mouth of an alley. She whistled at Jamie and called out an invitation, but half-heartedly.
"A pimp will be a-hiding in the alley with a cosh. Play you 3-1,
the chairman behind me remarked, his remarks punctuated by his breathing.
"Ain't as safe as when the army was here." "Think not," his partner grunted, then found breath to reply. "Army was here when that officer got his throat cut in a whorehouse. Reckons why that drab's out here in her shift."
He gulped air and went on.
"How do you mean to settle the bet, then? Go with her yourself?" "Maybe as this gentleman'll do us the service," the other said with a brief gasping laugh.
"It may be that he won't," I said, sticking my head out of the window, "but I'll go and look if you like."
Jamie and the forward man laughed, the other grunted, and we jolted gently round the corner and down the street to where the Shippen house stood, gracious in its own grounds, on a small rise near the edge of town. There was a lighted lantern by the gate, another by the door. I wondered whether that meant we were expected. I hadn't thought to ask Governor Arnold if he had sent word ahead of us. If he hadn't, the next few minutes might be interesting.
"Any notion how long we might be, Sassenach?"
Jamie inquired, taking out his purse to pay the chairman.
"If he's already dead, it won't take long," I replied, shaking my skirts into order. "If he's not, it could well take all night."
"Aye. Wait a bit, then,"
Jamie told the chairman, who was staring at me mouths agape.
"If I haven't come out in 10 minutes, you're free to go."
Such was the force of his personality, they didn't observe that they were quite free to go at once if they wanted, and merely nodded meekly as he took my arm and escorted me up the steps.
We were expected. The door swung wide as Jamie's boots scuffed the scrub stone of the stoop, and a young woman peered out, alarm and interest showing in equal measure on her face. Evidently, Mr. Bledsoe wasn't dead then.
"Mrs. Fraser," she blinked slightly, looking at me sideways. It is Mrs. Fraser. Governor Arnold said..."
"It is Mrs. Fraser,"
Jamie said, with a slight edge in his voice.
"And I assure you, young woman, I'm in a position to know."
"This would be Mr. Fraser," I informed the young lady, who was looking up at him, clearly bewildered. "I was probably Lady John Grey last time you saw me," I added, trying for a nonchalant matter-of-factness. "But yes, I'm Claire Fraser. Again." "I understand that your cousin..."
"Oh, yes. Please come this way."
She stepped back, gesturing toward the rear of the house, and I saw that she was accompanied by a servant, a middle-aged black man, who bowed when I met his gaze, and then led the way through a long hallway to the back stair, and thence upward. On the way, our hostess introduced herself belatedly as Margaret Shippen, and apologized prettily for the absence of her parents. Her father, she said, was called away on business. I hadn't been formally introduced to Peggy Shippen before, but I had seen her, and knew a bit about her. She'd been one of the organizing lights of the Miskianza, and while her father had prevented her actually attending the ball, all her friends had talked about her at length. And I'd glimpsed her, lavishly dressed, once or twice at other functions I'd attended with John.
Called away on business, was it?
I caught Jamie's eye when she'd said that, and he'd raised one shoulder in the briefest of shrugs. More than likely, Edward Shippen wanted to avoid any public linkage with his nephew's misfortune, and, so far as possible, keep talk about the incident to a minimum. It wasn't a safe time or place to make a point of loyalist leanings in the family. Miss Shippen led us to a small bedroom on the third floor, where a blackened, man-shaped object lay on the bed. The smell of tar was thick in the air, along with a distinct smell of blood and a sort of constant low moaning noise. This must be Tench Bledsoe. And wherever had he got a name like that, I wondered, gingerly approaching him. So far as I knew, a tench was a rather undistinguished-looking sort of carp.
"Mr. Bledsoe,"
I said quietly, setting down my basket on a small table. There was a candlestick on the table, and by the light of the single flame, I could make out his face, or half of it. The other half was obscured by tar, as was a good bit of his head and neck. The clean half was that of a somewhat plain young man, with a large, beaky nose, his features contorted in agony, but not at all fish-looking.
"Yes,"
he gasped, and pressed his lips tight together, as though even the escape of a single word jeopardized the tenuous grip he had on himself.
"I'm Mrs. Fraser," I said, and laid a hand on his shoulder. A fine shudder was running through him like current through a wire.
I've come to help.
He heard me and nodded jerkily. They'd given him brandy. I could smell it under the aromatic reek of pine tar, and a half-full decanter stood on the table.
"Have you any laudanum in the house?" I asked, turning to Peggy.
It wouldn't help that much in the long run, but a large dose might get us through the worst of the preliminaries. She was quite young, no more than 18, I thought, but alert and self-possessed, as well as very pretty. She nodded and disappeared with a murmured word to the servant.
"Of course," I thought, seeing her skirts whisk out of sight. She couldn't send him for it.
The laudanum would be with the other household simples, in a closet, under lock and key.
"What can I do, Sassenach?"
Jamie said softly, as though afraid to break the injured man's concentration on his pain.
"Help me undress him."
Whoever had attacked him hadn't stripped him, that was lucky. And most of the tar probably hadn't been boiling hot when it was applied. I smelled burnt hair, but not the sickening stench of cooked flesh. Pine tar wasn't like the asphalt road tar of later centuries. It was a byproduct of turpentine distillation, and might be soft enough to be daubed without needing to be boiled first.
What wasn't fortunate was his leg, as I saw at once when Jamie peeled back the sheet covering him.
That was where the smell of blood had come from. It spread in a soggy smear on the bedclothes, black in the candlelight, but copper and scarlet to the nose.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said under my breath.
Tench's face was dead white and streaked with sweat and tears. His eyes closed, but he grimaced, hearing that. Jamie set his jaw and drew his case knife, which was sharp enough to shave the hairs on a man's arm. Sharp enough to slice through the shredded stocking and damp breeches, spreading the stiffened fabric aside to show me the damage.
"Who did that to your man?"
he asked Tench, gripping him by the wrist as the injured man reached a tentative hand downward, seeking the extent of the damage.
"No one," Tench whispered and coughed. I jumped off the dock when he set my head afire and landed on one foot in the mud. It stuck well in and when I fell over."
It was a very nasty compound fracture. Both of the bones of the lower leg had snapped clean through, and the shattered ends were poking through the skin in different directions. I was surprised that he had survived the shock of it, together with the trauma of the attack, to say nothing of a night and part of a day spent lying in the filthy river shallows afterward. The macerated flesh was swollen, raw, red and ugly, the wounds deeply infected. I breathed in gently, half expecting the reek of gangrene. But no, not yet.
"He set your head afire?"
Jamie was saying incredulously. He leaned forward, touching the darkened mass on the left side of the young man's head.
"Who?" "Don't know."
Tench's hand floated up, touched Jamie's, but Tench didn't try to pull it away. It rested on Jamie's as though his touch would tell Tench what he needed to know but couldn't bear to find out for himself.
"Think he... where he spoke. Maybe England. Maybe Ireland."
"He poured pitch over my head and sprinkled feathers on. Others would have left me then, I think. But all of a sudden he turned back and seized a torch." He coughed, wincing against the spasm, and ended breathlessly,
"Like he hated me."
He sounded astonished. Jamie was carefully breaking off small chunks of singed hair and matted clumps of mud and tar, revealing the blistered skin underneath.
"It's none so bad, man," he said encouragingly. "Your ear's still there. No, but a wee bit black and crusty round the edges."
That actually made Tench laugh, no more than a breathy gasp, though this was extinguished abruptly when I touched his leg. "I'll need more light," I said, turning to the servant, "and a lot of bandages." He nodded, avoiding looking at the man on the bed, and left. We worked for some minutes, murmuring occasional encouragement to Tench. At one point, Jamie pulled the chamber pot out from under the bed, excused himself with a brief word, and took it into the hall. I heard him retching. He came back a few moments later, pale and smelling of vomit, and resumed the delicate work of uncovering what might remain of Tench's face.
"Can you open this eye, man?"
he asked, gently touching the left side. I peered up from my station over his leg to see that the lid was evidently whole but badly blistered and swollen, the lashes singed off.
"No."
Tench's voice had changed, and I moved abruptly up to his head. He sounded almost sleepy, his voice unconcerned. I laid the back of my hand against his cheek. It was cool and clammy. I said something very bad out loud, and his working eye sprang open, staring up at me.
"Oh, there you are," I said, much relieved. "I thought you were going into shock."
"If he hasn't been shocked by what's already happened to him, I shouldn't think anything would do it, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, but bent closer to look.
"I think he's only worn out from the pain, aye? Sometimes you cannae be bothered to put up with it any more, but you're no ready to die, so you just drift away for a bit."
Tench sighed deeply and gave a small, jerky nod.
"If you could stop for a little while," he whispered. "Please."
"Aye,"
Jamie said softly, and, patting his chest, drew the stained sheet up over him.
"Rest a bit, Muharridge."
I wasn't at all sure that he wasn't trying to die, but there was a limit to what I could do to prevent him if that were the case. And there was a much more serious limit to what I could do if he didn't die. On the other hand, I had a vivid understanding of exactly what Jamie meant by drifting away, and of the symptoms of severe blood loss. There was no telling how much blood Tench had lost, lying in the river. The fracture had, by some miracle, not ruptured either of the main tibial arteries. If it had, he'd have been dead long since. But it had certainly made a hash of a number of smaller vessels. On the other hand, the Delaware was a fairly cold river, even in summer. The chill of the water might well have constricted the smaller blood vessels, as well as slowed his metabolism, and even perhaps minimized the damage due to burns, both by extinguishing the fire and by cooling the burnt skin. I'd whipped a pro forma tourniquet bandage round the leg above the knee, but hadn't tightened it. Blood loss at the moment was no more than a slow oozing. And in fact, the burns were minimal. His shirt had been torn open, but the tar on his chest, hands and clothes hadn't been hot enough to blister his skin. And while there was certainly visible damage to one side of his face and head, I didn't think more than a few square inches of scalp had third-degree burns. The rest was redness and blistering. Painful, of course, but not life-threatening. Whoever had attacked him had likely not meant to kill him, but they stood a good chance of doing so anyway.
"Pitch capping, they call it," Jamie said, low-voiced.
We had moved away to the window, but he nodded back toward the bed.
"I haven't seen it before, but I've heard of it."
He shook his head, lips tight, then picked up the ewer and offered it to me.
"Do you want water, Sassenach?"
"No. Oh, wait. Yes, I do. Thank you." The window was firmly closed, in accordance with the custom of the times, and the small room was sweltering. I took the pitcher and nodded to the window. "Can you get that open, do you think?" He turned to wrestle with the window. It was stuck fast in its frame, the wood swollen with humidity and disuse.
"What about the leg?"
he said, back turned to me.
"You'll have to take it off, no?"
I lowered the pitcher. The water was flat and tasted of earth, and sighed. "Yes," I said. I'd been fighting that conclusion almost from the moment I'd seen Tench's leg, but hearing Jamie's matter-of-factness made it easier to accept. I doubt I could save it in a modern hospital, with blood transfusions and anaesthetic. And God, I wish I had ether right now. I bit my lip, looking at the bed, and watching closely to see whether Tench's chest was still rising and falling. A tiny, treacherous part of me rather hoped it wasn't. But it was. Feet on the stairs, and both Peggy and the manservant were with us again, armed respectively with a stable lantern and an enormous candelabra. Peggy, with a square glass bottle clasped to her chest. Both turned anxious faces toward the bed, then toward me, standing apart by the window. Was he dead? No, I said, shaking my head, and saw the same half-regretful relief flit across their faces that I had just experienced. I wasn't without sympathy. No matter what their feelings for the injured man, having him on the premises was a danger to the Shippens. I came forward and explained in a low voice what had to be done, watching Peggy go the colour of a bad oyster in the flickering light. She swayed a little, but swallowed hard and drew herself up.
Here, she said, I don't suppose you could take him to...
Well, no, I suppose not. She took a deep breath. All right, what can we do to help? The manservant coughed behind her in a meaningful manner, and she stiffened.
My father would say the same, she informed him coldly.
Just so, miss, he said, with a deference that wasn't all that deferential. But he might like to have the chance to say it himself, don't you think?
She shot him an angry glance, but before she could say anything, there was a grinding screech of wood as the window gave way to Jamie's will, and everyone's eye jerked to him.
I didn't mean to interrupt, he said mildly, turning round. But I do believe the governor has come to call.
Jamie pushed past Miss Shippen and her servant before either could react. He ran lightly down the back stair and came through the house, startling a kitchen maid. Clearly the governor wasn't going to be admitted by the kitchen door. He reached the front door just as a firm knock sounded and pulled it open.
Miss Margaret.
Arnold pushed past Jamie as though he wasn't there. No small feat. And seized Peggy Shippen's hands in his.
I thought, I must come. Your cousin? How does he do?
He's alive.
Peggy swallowed, her face the colour of the beeswax candle she was holding.
Mrs. Fraser is...
she says? She swallowed again, and Jamie swallowed with her, out of sympathy, knowing all too well what she was thinking of. Tench Bledsoe's shattered leg bones, red and slimy as an ineptly butchered pig's. The back of his throat was still bitter with the taste of vomit.
I thank you so much for sending Mrs. Fraser to us, sir. I couldn't think what on earth we were to do. My father's in Maryland, and my mother with her sister in New Jersey. My brother's...
She trailed off, looking distraught.
No, no, my dear. May I call you so? It is my most fervent concern to help you, your family, to protect you.
He hadn't let go her hands, Jamie noted, and she wasn't pulling them away. Jamie glanced covertly from Arnold to Peggy Shippen, then turned away a little, drawing back. It wasn't hard for them to ignore him. They were focused on each other. That made matters plain, or at least plainer. Arnold wanted the girl, and wanted her so nakedly that Jamie was slightly ashamed for the man.
You couldn't help lust, but surely a man should have enough control to hide it. And no just for the sake of decency either, he thought,
seeing a certain look of cautious calculation come into Peggy's face. It was, he thought, the look of a fisherman who has just seen a fat trout swim right under the lure. He cleared his throat in a pointed manner, and both of them jerked, as though he'd run a drawing pin into them.
"My wife says it will be necessary to amputate the injured leg," he said, "quickly. She requires a few things, instruments and the like."
"I need both the large saw and the small lunar one, the set of tunicula, the long things that look like fishing hooks, and quite a lot of sutures."
He was trying to keep the list in his head, though it made him ill to envision most of the items, thinking of the use they were about to be put to. Beneath the sense of revulsion and pity, though, was wariness. The same wariness he saw at the back of Benedict Arnold's eyes.
"Does she?" Arnold said, not quite a question.
His eyes flicked back to Peggy Shippen, who bit her lip in a becoming manner.
"Can you maybe send your coachman to the print shop?" Jamie asked. "I can go with him and fetch back what's needed."
"Yes," Arnold said slowly, but in an abstracted way, the way he did when he was thinking rapidly. "Or, no. Let us rather remove Mr. Bledsoe and Mrs. Fraser, to be sure, to the print shop in my coach. Mrs. Fraser will have access there to everything she requires, and the assistance and support of her family."
"What?" Jamie exclaimed.
But Peggy Shippen was already hanging on to Arnold's arm, her face transformed by relief. Jamie seized Arnold by the arm to compel his attention, and the governor's eyes narrowed. Jamie's intent had been to demand rhetorically whether Arnold was mad, but the split second's delay was enough to change this to a more politic.
"There's no room at the shop for such a venture, sir. We live atop one another, and folk come in and out all day. This will not be a simple matter. The man will need to be nursed for some time."
Peggy Shippen made a small moan of anxiety, and it dawned upon Jamie that Tench Bledsoe was a hot potato, as much or more, for Arnold as for the Shippens. The last thing Arnold could want as a military commander of the city was public scandal and disorder. The remaining loyalists in Philadelphia threatened and frightened, the Sons of Liberty seen as secret vigilantes, a law unto themselves. Arnold must very much want the incident kept quiet. At the same time, he wanted to be the noble knight riding to the aid of the very young and enchanting Miss Shippen by caring for her cousin while removing the potential danger he posed to her household.
"By bringing it to mine," Jamie thought,
his wariness beginning to turn to anger.
"Sir," he said formally, "there is no possibility of preventing the matter from being known should you bring yon man into my son's shop. And clearly you ken the danger of that."
The truth of this was evident, and Arnold paused, wrinkling his brow. But Jamie had fought with the man and kent him well enough. Jamie saw that, having made up his mind to relieve Miss Peggy's concern, Arnold meant to do it, come hell or high water. Evidently Claire was right in what she'd told him about testosterone, and he'd already known that Arnold was a ram, in terms both of balls and hard-headedness.
"Ah, I have it," Arnold exclaimed triumphantly.
And Jamie saw, with grudging admiration, the general emergent. This admiration disappeared with Arnold's next sentence.
"Lord John Grey," he said. "We could transport Mr. Bledsoe to his lordship's house." "No," Jamie said by reflex.
"Yes," Arnold said, but in self-congratulation rather than contradiction. He was paying no attention.
"Yes, the ideal solution.
His lordship and his brother are much in my debt," he explained to Peggy, with a feigned modesty that made Jamie want to hit him.
"And as his lordship and Mrs. Fraser..."
At this point, he caught sight of Jamie's face and arrested his speech just in time to prevent exactly such a happenstance. He coughed.
"The ideal solution," he repeated. "Will you go and tell Mrs. Fraser what we intend, sir?"
"We?" Jamie said.
"I ain't done nothing of the..."
"What the bloody hell is going on down here?" Claire's voice came from the stairway behind him, and he swung round to see her leaning on the banister, a flicker like a ghost in the light from the tin sconce above her. There was blood smudging her apron, blotches black on the pale cloth.
"Nothing, Ian," he said, fixing Arnold with a firm eye. "Only discussing where Mr. Bledsoe should be."
"I don't care where he should be," she snapped, coming down into the foyer, skirts rustling with agitation. "Where he will be is dead if I can't take care of his leg quickly." Then she noticed the glaring going on betwixt him and Arnold, and moved up beside Jamie, looking hard at the governor herself. "General Arnold," she said, If you have the slightest concern for Miss Shippen's cousin's life, you will oblige me by taking my husband promptly to fetch the instruments I need. Hurry!
Arnold blinked, and Jamie would have smiled had he not been worried for the lass. She was fierce, but she looked pale, and her fists were clenched in the cloth of her apron. It might have been to keep her from slapping the governor, but he rather thought it was to hide the fact that her hands were trembling, and he realized with a shock that she was afraid. Not afraid of the circumstance or any future danger, afraid that she couldn't do what she knew she must. His heart smote him at the thought. He took Arnold firmly by the upper arm, compelling him toward the stair.
"Aye," he said abruptly to Claire. "We'll take the man to Lord John's house, and whilst you fettle him for the job there, I'll fetch what you need from the shop. The general will help me to move him."
Arnold's stiff resistance ceased abruptly as he took Jamie's meaning.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, I..."
A long moan from above interrupted him, and Claire's face tightened. "There isn't time," she said quite calmly. "Miss Shippen, Peggy, fetch me the largest knife you have in the kitchen, and do it now. Have your servants bring more hot water and cloth for bandages, a strong sewing needle and black thread." Her eyes sought Jamie's, and he let go of the governor at once and went to her.
"You're right, lass," he said quietly, taking her elbow.
"I am," she said, and squeezed his hand briefly. "This is very bad, though. I don't... I'm sorry. I'll need you to help hold him."
"I'll be fine," he said. "Dinna be worried. Only do what you need to do. I promise I will na vomit on him while you're taking off his leg."
He hadn't actually meant that to be funny, and was surprised but pleased when she laughed. Not much of a laugh, but the tension in her arm relaxed, and her fingers were steady on his. He could tell the minute they entered the room. He didn't know what it was had changed, but clearly Claire had heard the beating of the wings of death from the floor below. He could sense them now. Bledsoe was still conscious, but barely so. A slice of white showed as one eyelid lifted at their entrance.
"We're here, man," Jamie whispered, sinking to his knees and grasping Bledsoe's hand.
It was cold to the touch and clammy with sweat.
"Dinna fash. We're here. It'll be done soon."
There was a strong smell of laudanum in the air, together with the stink of tar and blood and burnt hair. Claire was on the other side of the bed, holding Bledsoe's wrist, her eyes flickering from his slack face to the mangled leg. "Sepsis," she said quietly, but in a normal voice. "Do you see the red line there?" She gestured at the wounded leg, and Jamie saw it clearly, a streak of an ugly, dark red colour that he thought hadn't been there before. Or perhaps it had, and he'd not noticed. The sight of it made the fine hairs ripple on his shoulders, and he shifted uneasily. "Blood poisoning," Claire said. "Bacteria. Germs in the blood. It moves very fast. And if it should get into the body proper, there's nothing I can do." He looked up, sharp, hearing a tiny tremor in her voice.
"But before that, you might. There's a chance."
He tried to sound encouraging, though the thought of the alternative made the goose flesh that much worse. "Yes, but it isn't a good one," she swallowed. "The shock of the amputation may well kill him on the spot. And if it doesn't, there's still a great chance of infection." He stood up then and came round the bed to her, taking her gently but solidly by the shoulders. Her bones were close to the surface, and he thought her feelings were too.
"If he's got a chance, we must give it to him, Sassenach."
"Yes," she murmured. And he felt the shiver go all through her, though the air was hot and close. "God help me."
"He will,"
Jamie whispered, folding his arms briefly round her.
"So will I."
I was standing in the wrong place.
The fact that I understood what was happening to me didn't help at all.
A trained surgeon is also a potential killer, and an important bit of the training lies in accepting the fact. Your intent is entirely benign, or at least you hope so. But you are laying violent hands on someone, and you must be ruthless in order to do it effectively. And sometimes the person under your hands will die. And knowing that, you do it anyway. I had had them bring more candles, though the air in the room was already suffocating. The miasma of humidity and slowly evaporating sweat made the light of the candelabra fill the chamber with a gentle romantic glow. Just the thing for a dinner party, filled with wine, flirtations, and dancing. The wine could wait, and any surgeon dances with death routinely. The problem was that I'd forgotten the steps, and was flirting with panic. I bent to check Tench's heart rate and respiration. He was breathing shallowly but fast. Lack of oxygen, severe blood loss, and I felt my own chest tighten, heaving for air, and stood up, giddy, heart hammering.
Sasanach.
I turned, hand on the bedpost, to see Jamie watching me, eyebrows drawn together.
Are you all right?
Yes, I said, but my voice sounded queer, even to my own ears. I shook my head hard, trying to clear it. Jamie came close to me and put his hand on mine where it rested on the bedpost. It was big and steady, and it helped.
"You will not help him, lass, if you faint in the midst of it," he said, low-voiced.
"I'm not going to faint," I said, made a bit testy by anxiety. I'm fine. His hand fell away. And after a long, searching look into my face, he nodded soberly and stepped back. I wasn't going to faint, or at least I hope not. But I was trapped there in that close, hot room, smelling blood and tar and the scent of myrrh in the laudanum, feeling Tench's agony. And I could not do that. I couldn't. I mustn't. Peggy hurried in, a maidservant behind her, several large knives clutched to her bosom.
"Will one of these do?"
She laid them in a clinking heap at the foot of the bed, then stood back, gazing anxiously at her cousin's pale, slack face.
"I'm sure one will."
I stirred the heap gingerly, extracting a couple of possibilities. A carving knife that looked sharp, and a big, heavy knife of the sort used for chopping vegetables. And, with a vivid recollection of what it felt like to sever tendons, I picked up a paring knife with a freshly sharpened, silvered edge.
"Do you butcher your own meat, if you have something like a bone saw?"
The servant went as pale as a black man reasonably can, and went out, presumably to acquire one. "Boiling water?" I asked, brows raised.
"Chrissy is bringing it," Peggy assured me.
She licked her lips, uneasy.
"Do you..."
She broke off, narrowly avoiding saying what she so plainly thought.
"Do you know what you're doing?"
I did. That was the trouble. I knew much too much about what I was doing, from both sides.
"Everything will be fine," I assured her, with a decent appearance of calm and confidence. "I see we have needles and thread. Would you take the biggest needle, a carpet needle perhaps, and thread it for me, please? And then a couple of smaller ones, just in case."
Just in case I had time and opportunity to actually capture and ligate blood vessels. It was much more likely that the only choice I would have was cautery, a brutal searing of the fresh stump to staunch the bleeding. For Tench didn't have enough blood left to be able to spare any of it. I needed to be alone in my head, in a calm, clear place. The place from which I could see everything, sense the body under my hand in all its particularities, but not be that body. I was about to disjoint Tench Bledsoe's leg like a chicken's. Throw away his bones and flesh? Sear the stump.
and I felt his fear in the pit of my stomach. Benedict Arnold had come in with an armload of firewood and a silver table knife in one hand. My cautery iron, if there wasn't time to stitch. He set them down on the hearth, and the butler began to poke up the fire. I closed my eyes for an instant, trying not to breathe through my nose, shutting out the candle glow. Denny Hunter had operated on me by candlelight. I remembered watching through a haze of eyelashes, unable to open my eyes more than a crack, as each of the 6 big candles was lit, the flames rising up pure and hot, and smelling the small iron heating in the brazier beside them. A hand touched my waist, and gulping air, I leaned blindly into Jamie.
"What's wrong, Aeneen?"
he whispered to me. "Laudanum," I said, almost at random. You don't lose consciousness altogether. It makes the pain go away. Not stop. Just seem not connected to you. But it's there. And you know what's happening to you. I swallowed, forcing down bile. I felt it, the hard probe jabbing its way into my side, startling. The remarkable sense of cold intrusion mingled with incongruous, faint, warm echoes of internal movement, the forceful jabs of a child in the womb. "You know what's happening," I repeated, opening my eyes. I found his, looking down at me with gentleness.
"I ken that, aye,"
he whispered, and cupped my cheek with his four-fingered hand.
"Come and tell me what you need me to do, Mograi."
The momentary panic was subsiding. I forced it aside, knowing that even to think about it was to slide headfirst back into it. I laid a hand on Tench's injured leg, willing myself to feel it, find the truth of it. The truth was all too obvious. The lower leg was a complete wreck, mechanically, and so compromised by septicemia that there was no chance of saving it. I was searching desperately for a way to save the knee. Having a knee made a tremendous difference in the ability to walk, to manage, but I couldn't do it. He was far gone from injury, blood loss, and shock. He was a stubborn man, but I could feel his life flickering in his flesh, dying away in the midst of infection, disruption, and pain. I could not ask his body to withstand the longer, painstaking surgery that would be necessary to amputate below the knee, even if I felt sure that such an amputation would be sufficient to forestall the advancing septicemia, and I didn't. "I'm going to take his leg off above the knee," I said to Jamie. I thought I spoke calmly, but my voice sounded odd. "I need you to hold the leg for me, and move it as I tell you. Governor?" I turned to Arnold, who stood with a reassuring arm about Peggy Shippen's waist. "Come and hold him down." Laudanum alone wasn't going to be enough. To his credit, Arnold came instantly and laid a hand against Tench's slack cheek for a moment in reassurance, before taking firm hold of his shoulders. His own face was calm, and I remembered the stories I'd heard of his campaigns into Canada. Frostbite, injury, starvation. No, not a squeamish man, and I felt a small sense of reassurance from the presence of my 2 helpers. No, 3. Peggy Shippen came up beside me, pale to the lips and with her throat bobbing every few seconds as she swallowed, but jaws set with determination. "Tell me what to do," she whispered, and clamped her mouth shut hard as she caught sight of the mangled leg. "Try not to vomit, but if you must, turn away from the bed," I said. "Otherwise, stand there and hand me things as I ask." There was no further time for thought.